About 3 weeks ago, Pastor Gary asked me to attend the Intergovernmental Affairs Committee, which would discuss the proposed domestic partner certificate legislation. I readily admit my reticence in such matters. I just don't really get into those social issues. I'd rather spend time in my own ministry, my own family, my own life. I basically like to take the approach, put your head in the sand, and let the world go to pot. None of you feel that way, right? So whenever Pastor Gary comes in with his little book, you know, I'm going, uh-oh, what's coming? One of the justifications that I frequently give is that the church needs to be engaged in making disciples of Christ, the agenda of the gospel. And admittedly, there is a danger when we engage in social issues that we begin to focus on the social issues instead of the gospel. And I would never jettison that is the main agenda of the church, is to make disciples of Christ. Nevertheless, my limited interaction with the current challenge of redefining marriage and family at both the local and national levels has been a personal wake-up call to me. I'm not here to speak on that issue in particular, but rather for us to reflect from this passage of Scripture of an individual who engaged in public life, who engaged in a way that made a profound difference in a very pagan and secular culture, and does indeed set a model or a paradigm for you and me as believers, as Christians, to consider. In this story, I would suggest that God so orders our life situation as a platform of righteousness, which will rattle the pagan's cage, but does not intimidate us as we wait for God to achieve His prevailing purpose. Let me read that again, because this really is the essence of the message this morning. God so orders our life situation as a platform of righteousness, which will rattle the pagan's cage, but does not intimidate us as we wait for God to achieve His prevailing purpose. I want to unfold that statement to you in 5 steps. Let's first of all consider that God so orders our life situation. When you open the book of Daniel, you open it to a season of judgment. The first words of the book are these: "And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put in the treasure house of his God." That's Daniel 1, chapter 2. And what we find is that God was simply fulfilling the word that he had spoken to Hezekiah through Isaiah in Isaiah chapter 39. So Daniel finds himself in the middle of unfolding judgment. It was a season of judgment, but interestingly enough, it was a season of service. Despite God's hand of judgment, he strategically uses Daniel and his 3 friends to intersect with the pagan empire of Babylon, and then later the Mede and Persian empire. Despite the vast disobedience of God's people, there was a certain few, a remnant, who followed God and loved God. Daniel and his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, represent that remnant. They show a superior rule of God that is unmatched. A diet which they partake of that is very different from the king's in chapter 1. And then in chapter 3, we learn of the 3 friends. Daniel, we're not sure where he was, but 3 friends of his, or 3 men who stood up and would not bow down to the statute that represented the king of Babylon. We also learn about the wisdom of these men, who was really the wisdom of God through them, as Daniel revealed the dreams a couple different few times, revealed an interpretation on the wall that revealed the saying on the wall, which he interpreted that the Babylonian king Belshazzar could not understand and grab a hold of in the fifth chapter. And in fact, as we come to the end of that chapter, we find out that this glorious superpower kingdom falls. And so when we come to the sixth chapter, a brand new kingdom is in place. Darius, also known as Cyrus, takes over this kingdom, and you need to takes over the Babylonian kingdom, and you need to understand that this Mede and Persian kingdom is humongous. It's huge. It's a vast kingdom. So that explains why we have 120 administrative officials overseeing the various parts of the kingdom. The satraps, the protectors of the realm, provided security, and they were the IRS agents. Why are you laughing? The administrators kept financial records, and they protected the king's interest. So these three individuals would certainly need to be people that the king would trust, men who were men of integrity and honesty. We find that Daniel is one of those three individuals who is engaged in the public life of this particular kingdom. And he has the opportunity to serve in a way that we would never conceive of on our own. Here is a guy who had been taken captive. He was one of the noblemen, being somewhere between 15 and 20 years of age in the first chapter. Now he's about probably 80 years old. And yet the question is, who placed him in such a strategic position? Well, the book of Daniel clearly shows that it was God himself. One of the interesting things about the book of Daniel in the Old Testament is its similar picture for us as New Testament Christians. Up until the time of exile, we know of the nation of Israel actually being consolidated together as a national entity by itself. But now, they are dispersed. As we, believers, are dispersed throughout the world, representing God. But here's one interesting difference between Daniel and us. Daniel campaigned and voted for this position, right? He didn't. He didn't have a choice in the matter. And yet, Daniel did make the choice to use this position as a platform of righteousness. We have a choice to use the position, the life situation where we find ourselves, where God has placed us, to be used as that platform as well. Interesting. What we find about this man is that he is heads and shoulders above his colleagues. The New American Standard Bible in verse 3 puts it this way: Daniel began distinguishing himself because he possessed an extraordinary spirit. It's interesting when we look at the fifth chapter that he had the similar kind of reputation in the former kingdom. He carries it into this one. And he is distinguished because God's hand is upon him. It's very obvious that his life is enthralled with God. His life is involved very much with God. In fact, God has shaped his character, and it's unmistakable to everyone else who knows him. And quite frankly, he's of great benefit to the king. The king knows that he can trust him. Is that going to be important for the emperor? You better believe it. It's interesting that God's people, like you and me, can be channels of his common grace and goodness to an unregenerate society. Think about Joseph in the book of Genesis, where he was successful in Potiphar's home, as Potiphar received much blessing, or in the prison, and most obvious in Pharaoh's court during the time of famine. And so it was with Daniel, of great value to Darius. And we notice that value very clearly at the end of the story when the king is pretty upset and angry at himself for what has happened, because he knows of the value that Daniel is to him. The other interesting thing, and one of the most profound points of this man, Daniel, is that nobody can accuse him of wrongdoing. They've looked through his life, CNN and CBS and all of them, and they can't find anything wrong with him. Daniel made a difference as he contributed to the Mede and Persian government. You see, government by itself is not inherently evil. We learn from Romans 13 that God has established it to manage and maintain society and civilization that seeks to promote morality. Because we live in a world of sin, we know that government often is abused for selfish ends. And yet, like Daniel, we have an opportunity to make a difference. Michael Horton says, "Redemption does not change our participation in culture. Rather, it changes us and therefore the character of our involvement." End of quote. And we see how that was so with Daniel. So here's this platform that he has to use for God's glory. But whenever you are placed in those positions, whenever you find yourself engaged in culture representing God, you will most certainly rattle the pagan's cage. James Montgomery Boyce states, "If we practice our religion on the reservation and do not attempt to bring it into the world will tolerate us. But if we determine to take a stand on any important issue on the grounds of genuine religious principle, the fury of the secular society will break all bounds." We know that to be true, don't we? What was the motivation of these men? Why did they want to get rid of him? Well, probably, number one, he's a foreigner, and he's in a most prestigious position. He's over them. Jealousy would certainly play into it. We notice in the 13th verse, they speak of him as a Judean exile. Certainly, discomfort of honesty. He would keep them on their toes. They couldn't pass anything by him. That would be a good reason. And so his colleagues order it and try to paint this thing that they can't get anything on him with his character, so they will use the issue of his allegiance to his God and make it look like he is disloyal to the kingdom because of that allegiance to his God. And so they craft with the king, they craft this. We notice that they even go to the king in a crowd, you know, power in numbers. They go together. I'm not sure where Daniel was at the time. Maybe he was in another part of the kingdom. At any rate, they make it look like this is going to strengthen the king's power. This is going to strengthen his position, when they had absolutely no interest in the king's power at all, but what was going to work best for them. It's interesting that the king, who is in the most powerful position, seems to be naive. He seems to be manipulated. He's duped. And this person who's supposed to have all this power will be powerless to change that which he crafts and which he writes. We find then that it's very crafty and very sneaky in the way they go about this. And we as believers sometimes view things very naively. We think that, you know, if we take a stand, everything is going to be just wonderful and well. And the scriptures show us that that is not the case, as this story does. Jesus says, "Be as shrewd as snakes and as innocent as doves." As we intersect with our community in regard to morality, we confront an incredible foe. What we need to remember is that there is an opposing kingdom. It's like fireworks or sparks. As they hit, the friction happens immediately. But current trendy threats are not the things that dictate our response. A key phrase for me in this text is in verse 10. It's the words, just as he had done before. It wasn't like this new piece of legislation actually brought a new practice for Daniel. It's that which he had been continually doing all along. And Daniel just kept doing it. It's also interesting to note that Daniel didn't stop for 30 days. I mean, it's a month. Let's just take a little vacation from God. God knows everything anyway. But he doesn't do that, does he? How things are written and how they're described of his actions are very telling in that verse. We find him praying toward an open window that really reflects him looking, probably praying toward the direction of Jerusalem, a city that was desolate, a city that temporarily was abandoned by God, and yet we find a man undoubtedly holding on to the promise of God that his abandonment of that city, therefore the abandonment of his people, had an expiration date, that God would return to that city. And so as he looks to the city, he thinks of the promise of God, and that indeed as God would deliver his people, God would deliver him. We find him praying three times a day. That reminds us of Psalm 55. Evening, morning, and noon, I cry out in distress, and he hears my voice. He ransoms me unharmed from the battle waged against me, even though many oppose me. So Daniel was reflecting his absolute dependency upon God as he came to prayer three times a day. The fact that he kneels shows of his meekness and his humility, that he is ultimately dependent upon God to intervene. He is coming into God's presence. A couple things to notice here. First, Daniel is not intending for personal attention for himself, but rather to show without a shadow of a doubt that his fear and his reverence for God is greater than the government's. He takes to heart, or he well illustrates for us, the words of Jesus that we need to be more concerned about the one who can destroy both the soul and the body in hell than the threat of humanity and mankind. We don't find him picketing. We don't find him bringing a great rebellion against the kingdom. Of course, it would have been highly unsuccessful. But his activity of prayer was a lot more radical and certainly more effective. He's in the minority as well. Where his friends are, perhaps they're already dead and buried. He's 80 years old. You lose friends when you get old. Perhaps they're just in another part of the kingdom. He's all alone. But he still takes a stand. One author says, at times, a prophetic minority may be called to create a consensus on a given issue where none exists. So what do? We wait for God to do whatever he achieves his prevailing purpose. Do you think Daniel was surprised that they came and arrested him? No. He was fully cognizant of it. He was fully aware that it would happen, that it would occur. Now, he's asking God for help. That's what it says. When they came to see him, they saw him that he was praying for God, to God for help. Well, we would think God would immediately intervene, that God would stop right then. But indeed, his life would need to dangle over the mouths of the lions in order to see that God indeed would intervene. What's really intriguing to me is the great contrast between Daniel's temperament and attitude and the king's. The king tries every conceivable way during that day to try to rescue Daniel. The most powerful man in the world is unable to rescue Daniel from the very law that he crafted and that he designed. We find, actually, as he is thrown into the den, him making an incredible statement from the king himself. May your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you. Have you ever had those nights that you just couldn't sleep? He did. He didn't sleep a wink. We can just envision him pacing the floor, not able to eat, no entertainment, no cable TV, nothing tonight. But I bet Daniel's sleeping really well. He goes to the cave the next morning. He's just got to find out. We just sense the apprehension within his voice as he calls out to Daniel. And Daniel responds. He's alive. The angel from God had shut the mouths of the lions. The king is extremely excited. And yet we notice an incredible sense of serenity and peace. A perfect illustration of Isaiah 26:3. You will keep in perfect peace him whose mind is steadfast because he trusts in you. James, quoting James Montgomery Boyce again, he says, he was in the safest place in all Babylon, and that night I'm sure he slept marvelously. And so a new edict is written. A new edict that would praise and give reverence to the God of Daniel. Not as one of the gods, but as the God. As the one who would endure. As the one who indeed is the God of gods. The God we serve is able to save us. Think about that Daniel could have very easily been dinner for the lions. When we look in the third chapter, his friends say to the king, the God we serve is able to save us from it, and he will rescue us from your hand, O king. But even if he does not, we want you to know, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up. Could not those words have been placed in the lips of Daniel? I think so. God doesn't always bring immediate rescue. Sometimes God so orders that his servants lose their lives. Look at Acts 12. James lost his life. Peter did not. God so orders things in his counsel, in his way. And yet, we know that that is not the end of the story, even if life is lost. We notice that there is an incredible change and an incredible shift now as a result of Daniel's obedience. Willing to hang in there with God, knowing that God would do what he would want to do. So I quickly conclude with these points. Sometimes we may or may not choose our place of service. But whatever place of service we find ourselves in, we have to make the decision, we have to choose for God to unfold his reign and rulership in our lives. Second, we may legitimately contribute our talents in the public arena as Daniel fulfilled his own responsibility with integrity. Creation goes beyond the physical. It includes the cultural institutions, such as the state, the economy, the family, ideas, social rules, and regulations. And God is able to use his people to infiltrate and to influence for that which would be positive and right and would reflect his glory. But also, our public contribution flows from a conviction that Christ is the supreme ruler. When we think about the idea of God ruling, of God setting up his kingdom forever and ever, as New Testament Christians, we must think of it in light of Christ, who has already won the battle. The battle's outcome, the war's outcome is already taken care of. It's from that foundation, it's from that basis which we intersect into our culture. We might not see it immediately fulfilled in our project or that which God has called us to do in our lifetime. But we must understand that the battle has already been won. And so we contribute with realism. We know that, indeed, we might be the Lion's Supper that day. But we know that ultimately, the enemy has been defeated. And we serve from not an immediate perspective, but from an eternal one. And do it with confidence for the glory of God.